You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Seven thirty-seven on a Tuesday. Joining me from, I believe, Quantico, Virginia, is retired Marine Colonel Mary Reinwald. Mary, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning.
Well, first of all, thanks for doing this.
No, we appreciate it.
All right. First of all, we need to learn about you, but how was your Labor Day weekend? Good?
Oh, my Labor Day weekend was very good. I went down to Emerald Isle near Camp Lejeune, and had a great time, even though the hurricane passed over the first day. But all good on this end.
Give us the, since you're our weather correspondent from Emerald Islands, how did everybody do down there? Everybody do okay?
Oh, it did. You know, it was actually very easy. The hurricane had, or I guess it was a tropical storm by the time it hit, passed out to sea. So we just got some waves and some rain the first night into Saturday, and by Sunday it was beautiful.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. All right, so Labor Day behind us, and hopefully cooler weather on the way for everybody. And as everybody gets heads back to school, my daughter starts eighth grade today, so it's a big day in the house. Exactly. First of all, let's learn about you. Born and raised where, Mary?
Well, I was born in Philadelphia, but moved all over. Somebody called me a corporate brat. And I thought that was most appropriate. But lived all over the East Coast.
Oh,
and then,
really?
Went to Penn State and joined the Marine Corps from there.
I don't know. I've never heard the term corporate brat. I just thought they were brats.
Well, in my case, that may be true. But.
How did the Marine Corps get on your horizon? You're a corporate girl, and obviously he was successful. He retained employment. And so how does a corporate brat go to a very unbrat-like place in terms of the Marine Corps, which doesn't suffer them well? How did the Marine Corps get on your horizon?
You know, especially in the early 80s when I went to college. But I had a father who believed that he put himself through college, and he believed that his children should. And he said, unless you plan on going to the University of Georgia, where we were living at the time, you better figure something out. And they had two good-looking young Naval Academy recruiters come to my high school, and I knew I didn't want to go to the academy, but they started talking about NROTC. So I joined, or I applied for an NROTC scholarship, started off with the Navy option, and within a month of getting to Penn State, I knew I wanted to be a Marine. So I switched my option, and the rest is history.
All right, so your dad is one of those guys that, like Elton John, I'm not giving my money to my kids. Like,
there were seven of us, so there wasn't a lot of money.
Mel Gibson said the same thing, and Mel Gibson, I think, said the same thing, and so did, who's the other guy? Sting said the same thing. Yeah, they can earn their own. And you're going, wow, this is crazy. And so what specifically happens relative to the Marine Corps? Because the Marine Corps is not the military, especially for females at the time. I mean, still might not be a very friendly place.
The irony of the whole thing is that when I got to Penn State, the fact that I was a woman never really entered into the equation. It was the most welcoming environment I think I've ever been in. The guys did not care. They're like, if you think you can be one of us, give it a shot. As long as you can live up to our standards, we really don't care. So I came into the Marine Corps expecting that kind of environment. I was a little unpleasantly surprised along
the
way.
Hello. Okay, so let's stop for a second. Penn State, Joe Paterno, give me your take on the whole thing.
Very, very sore spot. You know, Joe Paterno in so many ways built that university.
Right.
Here's the irony. I'm a Marine. So you got the you got the sexual assault issue in the Marine Corps and the military.
Right.
I went to Penn State, you got Joe Paterno, and I'm Catholic. So I always say I hit the trifecta. And my last assignment on active duty was the DOD SAPRO. So I know the intricacies and the complexities of that problem, probably better than most, at least many Americans. I think, you know, did Paterno do enough? No. And I think he'd be the first to tell you. But I think it became such a distraction because it was Joe Paterno and all the joke. And, you know, and we have a wonderful phenomenon in this country about trying to tear down you know, those who've achieved the mountaintop.
Right.
There were so many times I'm watching TV and you would have thought Joe Paterno was the pedophile, not Jerry Sandusky.
Right.
So I knew the layers of that. I knew Paterno and Sandusky hated each other. I also know the way the pedophiles like Jerry Sandusky work. Jerry Sandusky was basically a saint to everybody in central Pennsylvania. All the things that he did, the foster kids, the programs he set up, the just taking care of kids one right after another. So there were so many red flags along the way that we see now, but back then you may have seen them, and people who know him would say, oh, no, Jerry Sandusky, he's saint-like. He would never do something like that. So I think Joe Paterno took way too much brunt of all of that. But I think the goodness that came out of it is that so many more people are aware and so many more people understand that it's just not as simple as you want to make it out to be. And it's also not as simple as just blaming one guy, where there's a series of people along the way who I'm sure are kicking themselves now going, why didn't I do more also? And you just can't level it on one man. Plus, you know, if you know Joe Paterno was never all about winning. He was about the university. He was about, you know, studying, getting your degree, making the world a better place. So I think he took a lot of criticism that was unwarranted. But again, I think he'd be the first to tell you he wished he'd done more in the whole, especially during the end.
You know, there was so much. Now we digress, but I find it interesting that you went there and your background, that the hat trick of oh my God. You know, a lot of people said, you know, I don't think he really understood what was going on. Do you buy that? I mean, because I actually do. You do.
If you think about his age, but not just him, I think society didn't know. You know, I think go back to, you know, all the Catholic priests. You know, how often there were so many red flags with individual cases there too. But in many ways, you got to remember that generation and America up until the last 20, maybe even 30 years. You know, we didn't talk about sex. We didn't talk about abuse. We didn't talk about those things. So you just, you know, everybody had that weird uncle that you kind of just said, okay, I'm just going to stay away from. I think there was some naivete, but I also think as much people didn't talk to him about those things. You know, he was old school. He was like your father. He was like your grandfather. I don't want to talk to my dad about that kind of things. So I think that was all part of it. Plus, like I said, Sandusky's a pedophile. He's a predator. He knew exactly what he was doing. You know, I attended some seminars and some conferences on the subject, and I asked one guy who was a victim of not just one, but multiple priests at some points in his life. And he said, you know, it's almost like, do they go to a school for this? Because these predators know exactly who to groom, exactly who to take care of. You know, and they don't get the strong, they don't attack the strong, confident individuals. They attack the ones with maybe some family problems, who may be going through some things, maybe appear to be weaker. They know exactly what they're doing. So they may know, but guys like Joe Paterno, you know, God, country, Catholicism, and football, you know, he's not exposed to that stuff, and it really doesn't enter his, you know, this is all supposition on my part.
Right.
I don't think he's thinking about that. He may not like Jerry Sandusky, but, you know, he's not thinking, no way in hell is that guy a predator.
Interesting. You know what? And then there's moments in your life when a window opens and closes and you have a chance to jump through. And, you know, I mean, Joe Paterno, you know, went from, you know, being one of the most, you know, revered, you know, football coaches in the country to, you know, the statue torn down and all of that. And his legacy essentially, I don't know what we'd call it, not only tarnished, but I don't know what a better word for, but certainly hammered in terms of all the good that he did do. So just a horrible story all the way around, no matter how you cut slice it.
Well, and you have to remember, Joe didn't want that statue. You know, so that's number one. That's not what he was about. He, you know, in his mind, I think the more important thing was the library that he donated millions of dollars to, the Penn State Library. And I think that in terms of his legacy, that's the shame of all of this. The man did so much good, and now he's a punchline.
Right.
He's been disparaged by people who don't know him and really don't know anything about the rest of his life and his career. And again, who in many ways equate him to Sandusky.
Right.
And you can't do that. If you start equating Joe Paterno, well, let's run through the list. You know, all the way down to, you know, the families of the kids who were abused, you know, they have some responsibility in taking care of their children and allowing somebody like Sandusky to have such a big role in their lives. to the principals of the schools that were letting Sandusky walk in and just take kids out without their parents' permission. And even if they had the permission, everybody's like, oh, it's Sandusky, oh, it's good to go. You know, and of all people, you know, Joe Paterno is the one that bears, seems to be punished in so many ways more than just about anybody else.
Well, certainly it's not, the punishment is not equal. And, you know, it's interesting, you made a comment about how much money that football coaches, you know, make universities. Mm-hmm. And somebody mentioned, said over the course of the weekend to me about Michigan. They said, I wonder how long it's going to be till Harbaugh wears out his welcome. I said, well, let me tell you this. He will put them back in, and you know, they'll be consistently in the top 10 football programs in the country. They will go to the biggest bowl games, which will mean hundreds of millions of dollars in increased revenue for the University of Michigan, and the alumni will love him. So I don't care, you know, he's going to have a long stay if that's what he wants, because of the money piece, because the money that you're talking about is national television money, and that's gigantic money. And that shouldn't be lost on anybody when we talk about the business of sports. So
and you're exactly right. And take it to the next level. And how much a good coach, and by good I mean good in terms of success on the football field, brings to a university. Penn State in the 60s, when Joe Paterno got there, was a relatively small, especially by today's standards, you know, state college. And now, because of the success of the football team, that brings in so many more research grants, so many more professors, so many more, you know, you expand because people like me who was at, I was living in Georgia, you know, but I was following Penn State football back then. That was one of the big reasons I picked Penn State.
Right.
So, you know, the second, third, fourth order effects along the way, you know, are incredible on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I'll be the first to tell you, Joe should have retired at least 10 years before he did.
I was going to ask you that. Is there a lesson in that institutionally for, you know, Bear Bryant, they did the same thing. You still see people wearing his hat down in Alabama. And I heard a funny story, kind of a joke, that he had stayed too long. But he looked at somebody on the sideline and said, Get McNamara in there. And the assistant coach like, well, he graduated 6 years ago. And he said, but Bear Bryant was such a big personality, they started looking in the stands for him. It's like, hey, man, if that guy wants that guy in there, get his ass in there. But is there must be a lesson in there. But those guys financially, and the big donors of the state that donate to the university that roll in and say, hey, look, if he wants to stay, leave him alone. Right.
Yeah, and over the wants of probably the university professor and others.
Exactly.
And my understanding was that Joe was spending his last years as much time fundraising, as much time speaking on behalf, because he was such an icon, as he was on the football field. So, you know, I think at some point that's when you know the tipping point's been reached and it's time to go.
Right.
Plus, it's hard for him to relate to, you know, when you're in your 70s and 80s, how hard is it to relate to the young kids today, you know?
Yeah,
I've got
children
in their 20s. It's hard to relate to them.
My guest this morning is retired Marine Colonel Mary Reinwald, United States Marine Corps, and she is the editor of Leatherneck Magazine. And so let's talk about your Marine Corps career. What was your MOS?
I was an O-180. I was an adjutant.
Right. And take us through, give me a couple people in your career that had a huge influence on you.
One of the biggest was Colonel Lenny Sutko, artillery officer who I knew as the CO of 12th Marines when I was the ADJ and then the G1 in Okinawa for 3rd Marine Division. He had 12th Marines, and then he came up to be the chief of staff. And one of the finest leaders I've ever met. And knew how to take care of Marines, but also knew how to get the job done and accomplish the mission. And, you know, just one of those Marines that you look at and you want to emulate, and you say, hey, you know, how do you get Marines to both the respect but the love, the affection? And, you know, he took care of me as a young female major. And I know that probably deep in his heart he wasn't a big fan of women in the Marine Corps, but you never would have known it. He put me in a colonel's billet as a major.
Wow.
In many ways made my career. So I would say he's the number one.
Who's number two?
You know, number two would be, and it's a little ironic, a couple of my peers. I went to the War College, Marine Corps War College, with both Brigadier General Eric Smith and Brigadier General Dale Alford, who personality-wise could not be more different.
Mm-hmm.
But together, you know, it's really neat when your peers can appreciate what you bring to the table. And, you know, incredibly smart, but more importantly, they know how to lead Marines, they know how to take care of Marines, and they understand the big picture. And they're self-sacrificing and dedicated. I mean, everything you read about, all the leadership traits, I'm so proud of both of them, and I'm so glad that they are where they are in the Marine Corps today. And I'm hoping one of them makes commandant, because I have a list of things I want them to change when they get up there. So.
No, I don't know Alfred, but I know Eric Smith. In fact, I did an interview with him in 2005 when he's the battalion commander of 1-5 in Ramadi, and it's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. If mm-hmm. you want to hear a great interview about purpose and determination, Eric Smith from Ramadi in 2005 is in our archive, so you can go look it up. But it's a great interview.
I will.
It absolutely is. You would enjoy it. And give me a couple of when did you retire?
I retired in February of 14.
Okay. Combat deployments. Give me a
look. Didn't make it to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Either
actually.
Place?
No. Yeah. It was a series of unfortunate events. We'll just put it that way. But I got command, and my command, because I was an O-1, was at the admin school, which resulted, you know, did well, got selected for school. Coming out of school, I was deliberately selected for the Marine Corps War College to go serve at Command and Staff College. And then by then, by the time I get out of there, I'm pinning on colonel, and the jobs for an 0180 colonel are few and far between. Actually, thought I had a shot to get to Afghanistan when the G1 of Tumas broke her arm, broke it very badly, and she wasn't supposed to go back, and I was lined up to go, and then that fell through because she, God bless her, and she did the right thing. She pushed very hard to get back in the fight.
No, she didn't. She screwed you over. tell me, how does the Marine Corps Gazette opportunity? I don't want to say fall into your lap, but how does that happen? How do you get there?
Well, like so many, it's Leatherneck. I always get people always say that. But that's Woody, Chris Woodbridge.
I know.
And he does much better than I ever would, let me tell you. you know, it's funny. It's like so many things in the Marine Corps, it's about who you know. And the now COO made a recommendation to our COO, Colonel Dan O'Brien, retired, made the recommendation to our CEO, Major General Ed Usher, to interview me. And so I come up for the interview, and, you know, obviously the number one criteria was to be a Marine. Number two, they preferred a colonel. And, you know, with my background as an adjutant, they said, well, you know, do you have any editing background? I said, well, I was the editor of my high school yearbook. So that's about it.
And I've been unscrewing your recommendations and every other thing
for years and years.
So maybe.
Well, and the other big criteria was who in terms of promotions and things like that is can you get the Marine Corps Association and Foundation? Can you help us get in the door at various places? And you know the one thing I do know is a lot of Marines, so that helped. And they offered me the job, and of course I jumped at it. And I've been here about 2.5 years, and loved every minute of it.
What's the best part of being the publisher of Leatherneck, the editor of Leatherneck?
You know, the best part is talking to our readers and our members, because I tell the one day, I had a veteran of the Chosen Reservoir walk in my office, and he talked to me for an hour and a half, and he, you know, as he should have, he did most of the talking. And then I get off the phone, and I am talking to Marv Levy, the Super Bowl football coach, four-time Super Bowl football coach, whose father was a Bella Wood. His father was gassed at Bella Wood, and he had written a poem that had made its way to me. So we published it, and I want to say it was the May 15 issue, and actually a very nice poem. And he also served. He served in the Army in World War II. So I'm talking to him, and then a little bit later I'm talking to the Commandant of the Marine Corps. So I'm running, you know, the history of the Marine Corps to the present day of the Marine Corps. And they're saying, you know, they understand the value of Leatherneck, the connection we have to our readers. Leatherneck will be 100 years old next year. The Marine Corps Association is already over 100 years, and we do good things, and we keep a connection for so many people, and mainly veteran Marines. That's the irony. We don't deal with mainly retired Marines. My readers are from the 15-year-old who's thinking about joining the Marine Corps to the 94-year-old Iwo Jima vet who'll call and tell me when I mess up, and trust me, they call. And that's not how it was, you know, those kind of things. So that's what I enjoy the most.
Tell me about the Leatherneck archives. Is there like a vault that you go in that creaks and that has this the repository of all kinds of cool stuff?
It is. It's digital actually now, but I have a copy of every Leatherneck magazine ever published, and they're all online. And it's, we say that's a benefit of our membership, that, you know, obviously you can, we'll send you a hard copy of both the Gazette or the Leatherneck, whichever one you choose, mm-hmm. but you also can go online and access any article. And, you know, the really neat thing is we have academics, we have active duty Marines, we have all kinds of people call us and, you know, and ask for permission to republish an article that was in Leatherneck, say, in 1951, or a Gazette article by Krulak in 1932. In so many ways, I mean, obviously there's the history division for the Marine Corps, but right. we own a very, very significant part of Marine Corps history, and it's accessible to all of our members.
Do you yoke up the historical people and say, let's get real, fellas? We know who the true historical division is, and let's not get confused, lest we do this in public. Do you ever, do you ever fire across their brow like that?
Not so harshly, because, you know, here, the big problem both of us have is there's so much information and we don't have the personnel to keep up with it. So we really do try and support each other. We'll get calls from them. They'll get calls from us. What do you got on this topic? What can we do? Well, for example, with the Iwo Jima piece,
right.
Charlie Niemeyer, the director of the history division, called me over and said, hey, can we get the Lowry photos from you? What else do you guys have? So we dug in. We pulled some old articles that had been done and worked together with them. So it's very, very complimentary between the two organizations.
Yeah, I will tell you this. Charlie Niemeyer from the historical division. Now, you hear that and you think, guy's got to be a straight-up doofus, right? First of all, that name. Then he's a PhD at the history division. This guy is so pegging the dork meter. And then he came on and he was absolutely entertaining and insightful. And I thought, wow, would have never, ever thought, you know, my...
Well, retired Marine.
Well, I know, but he's got all the wrong things going. So anyway, pretty interesting. I want to ask you real quick about not real quick. We're going to take a break in a couple of minutes. So let me ask you, what's the most interesting thing that's happened to you? And I'll force you to pick only one since you got to Leatherneck. Single most interesting thing.
Probably the Iwo Jima, the first Iwo Jima Yuli panel session. That was
the first session.
The first session.
What did you know walking into the session?
I knew what most Marines know. I knew, you know, the basics of the battle. I could name most of the flag raisers who I thought at the time. I understood the significance of it, and I walked in the door hoping to God that we had it right the first time and that everything I was hearing wasn't correct, because I understood how important and what a huge slice of Marine Corps history and how iconic that battle was and what it meant. And I thought, you know, God help us if we got this wrong. And I knew the repercussions. I think, you know, there were several wonderful people sitting on that panel. But at one point I was one that had to say, trust me on this, guys, this is going to be big, because this is what my readers, you know, if they're any indication of the rest of America, this is gonna have second, third, and fourth order effects, and it did.
So you walked in there, and as you saw the was that the first time you had seen the new evidence, or I'm sure you had read the article in the Omaha World Herald before you went there. But is that the first time you had it laid out for you, or what?
I had it laid out to a much lower degree about a year ago.
Okay.
And I was talking to the history division because, you know, the Leatherneck is not part of the Marine Corps, but we're very closely aligned. And I talked to the history division and said, what are you guys going to do? We'll follow your lead on this one, you know, because we follow the Marine Corps official record. And they said at the time, no, we don't think there's anything to this. And then they started investigating it a little bit more. And that's when it all, when it was like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there is something here. And we followed their lead, and I got the call in many ways because of Lou Lowry and his photos to help with the board and come sit on the panel.
And Lou Lowry, his photos were, you guys were the repository of that stuff?
We are. He was a Leatherneck photographer. He was an active duty Marine, staff sergeant back then in World War II, and then he was on the staff for years afterward.
Wow.
And he took the photos at the first flag raising. And the irony is the second flag raising, he took, you know, obviously the first flag went up, and then I heard two conflicting accounts, but I think what happened was some Japanese popped out of one of the caves,
right.
And he went to jump out of the way and lost his camera, broke his camera, went down the hill and asked for another one, and Norm Hatch, another iconic Marine involved in so much Marine Corps history and a very, very big combat correspondent, photographer, a along the way, he said, oh, heck no. I've only got one camera. You can't have it. So, you know, our best photographer wasn't on top of the mountain when the pictures for the second flag raising.
Well, you would think Leatherneck could have got him a little bit more durable camera.
You would hope.
Yeah, what the hell's up with that?
Well, these are the lessons learned from both sessions of the Yoli panel. I want to speak to every public affairs type out there. Hey, get names. Make sure you have extra cameras. Lowry missed the first flag raising in the middle of it. He needed to reload film. You know, it's little things like that that just make you bang your head against a wall.
Was he officially counseled? What the hell? Lowry, look.
Nobody.
I know there was a bit of a battle going on around you, but, you know, these are the basics of being a good combat correspondent, and you are obviously missing the mark here. And mm-hmm. you need to get your shit together, huh?
Yeah, come on, Marine.
Exactly. All right. My guest this morning is the editor of Leatherneck Magazine, and she participated. Do those panels have an official title?
They're called the Yoli panel.
The what?
The Yoli panel, General Jan Yoli.
Oh,
they named the panel.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's not official. That's just how we refer to it, I guess.
Yoli
but he
panel.
Was the president of the panel.
All right. And they reviewed, you'd say, what was the purpose of the panel?
The first session of the panel was to review the records of the second flag raising to determine whether or not Doc Bradley was in the photos. And and after that, when we came out with the findings, the commandant looked around and said, you know, while we're at it, let's go back. Let's do the first flag raising, too, because that's just as important.
How many times did you meet?
There were two distinct sessions between for the flag raisings, but we met for the second flag raising, the first session, because we did it in reverse order.
Right.
We met, I think it was 4 or 5 days straight, and then there was a break of a week and then a couple more days.
Wow, so you probably met a total of 7 times or so?
Oh, easily. Especially, and then we had the first flag raising, and that was 3 or 4 days. It locked in a room.
You know what? Again, I would have to tell you this, Mary. I'm tremendously jealous as somebody who's read a lot about... I heard General Zinni speak at the basic school when I was an instructor there in 1990. And he said, you know, pick a battle. Doesn't matter. It could be from any time. And learn everything you can learn about one battle, where it fit in the strategy of the war, where it fit in the operational strategy of the war. And then everything, how they communicated, how they did logistics, how they did tactics, how they did medical, how they administrated. Learn everything you can, and then continue with that over the course of time, the way you look at the battle will change. You won't simply see it through a tactical lens. You'll see it through a variety of lenses. And so I thought, well, I like reading about Iwo Jima. It was very unique. So I have to say it's with great envy that I have you on the program this morning, that you guys could sit there and look at. And one of the things that Charlie Niemeyer said when he came on was, you know, when I expressed the same kind of jealousy to him, he said, you know, Leatherneck is the one that has really, really cool stuff because Lowry worked for them, and they have a lot of this original stuff and very, very cool. So I have to tell you
that. and that got me on the board.
Exactly. We need to include her because she's got it.
I think you got great advice. That's incredible. I wish I'd heard that, and actually every lieutenant should hear that at the basic school. The only thing I will add is that you may have been more frustrated than we were with the conflicting evidence, because you're reading things, and the first question we quickly learned to ask was, when did he say that? When did he write that? Because so many things were written 30, 40 years after the fact, and were in conflict with, I mean, several things were in direct conflict with photographic evidence.
Right.
So the memories were faulty. I'm 50 years old. I can understand it. If he said to me, go back to, a seminal event in my 20s, I would hope I'd get it right, but the odds are pretty good that I'd miss some details. So we quickly learned that eyewitness accounts are not as accurate as we all would assume they were.
You know, and... The mission of All Marine Radio is post-combat related mental health and helping guys transition. And to me, there's some interesting post-combat related mental health lessons that come out of John Bradley, that come out of Harold Schultz. That you see the way these guys deal with it, and there's some interesting discussion, and we'll talk about those things. But let me take a quick break. My guest this morning from Leatherneck Magazine is its editor, and her name is Mary Reinwald from Penn State University. And she's she's a corporate brat. Never heard that term before. And we'll continue with her on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave service women. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We're the sidewalk in.
8:11 on the West Coast. 11:11, which would be Veterans Day on the East Coast. If it was a date, it's actually the time this morning, so just so nobody gets crazy. And rejoining me, is Colonel Mary Reinwald, and she is retired in 2014, currently the editor of the Leatherneck magazine, and she's been gracious enough to give up her time today, and we appreciate that. So, Mary, let's talk about the Yuli panel. So, you guys go in, and this thing is I won't say the Rosetta Stone, but if the commandments were carved in stone, this is certainly an image and names that are carved in Marine Corps history. And there is no more prominent image of the Marine Corps than that, whether it's simply a silhouette of that. Just about everybody in the United States will tell you, yeah, that's something to do with the Marine Corps. All right.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I know that has to do with Marines. You drive down I-95 at night, you see the silhouette of the cathedral, and it is that image. So you guys walk in the room. I'm curious, what was the first time where you looked and had the because I did the same thing when I read, when I saw the article in the Omaha World Herald. There was no doubt in my mind that wasn't Job Bradley. I know that people's mind plays tricks on them, blah 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 blah. But I'll tell you what: if you gave me my war belt and all the things that I put on it when I was a lieutenant, I'll put that thing together for you right now. And if I wore my leggings. And there's no doubt in my mind the way the uniform that I wore. So I might not remember a lot, but I will tell you this. In my mind, I know that I would remember that stuff. And the differences in the pictures, and the Omaha World Herald did a great job in terms of they digitized the pictures, and so you could roll your mouse over it, and it would blow this thing up. And I remember looking at that going, holy shit. How could it not be John Bradley? And of all the people not to be in the picture, it's the,
of course, yeah.
Right? It's the corpsman whose kid wrote a book about it that got made into two movies. You got to be kidding me. Nice going, public affairs people. Way to screw this one up. So when was the first time that you looked at that and went, oh, my God.
First of all, everything you said, you got to remember the context of when we all saw this. We saw this in the year, in 2000, somewhere in 2000, where we had, we had a mouse on our computer to run over and see things. You know, my big thing is that I was at Sunset Parade a couple weeks after the panel recess, and I'm looking at the statue going, how did we miss this? There's no medical kit. That's the glaring thing. There's no medical kit hanging from the man in the fourth position.
And is there no medical kit, his equipment, that's that guy's fighting. He's not a medical guy, you know. And so you look at it and you just go, how did we miss it? Holy smoke.
Well, you know, it's actually, there's a whole series of things that I think happen, and a lot of it is just flat-out supposition. You know, what we all forget is that on the island that day, the significant flag raising was the first one.
Right.
That's when the flag went up. The ship's horns went off. The Marines on the beaches were cheering. Everybody was ecstatic. When the second flag went up, it was simply they were exchanging the flags.
Right.
The lieutenant sitting there was watching the first flag come down and wasn't even paying attention to the second flag. So, in their minds, okay, we're just swapping out a flag. So when people start talking about it later, well, Bradley was there. Yeah, wasn't Bradley there? We think Bradley was there.
Right. And he was actually
in the first flag raising. Right. Which is the irony is that Hansen, who was supposed to be, who was initially thought to be in the second flag raising,
right,
was not, and he's in the first flag raising.
Right. But you know what? Until you see the Janoust video.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of see the longer version of it where they're standing there, Ira Hayes, Mike Stranks there, and Harlan Block. They're holding this piece of pipe, right? And they're affixing this second flag to it. And it's a working party. And then they stick it in the ground.
And it
happens in the blink of an eye. They're just like, all right, let's go. Boom. And they stick it in the ground. And then what takes them the longer time is trying to get the thing to stand up straight and finding wires.
Move the blocks over.
Right, move the block. But when you see it happen, you see the miracle that Rosenthal's photo is. It's this blink of an eye, one in a gazillion. image where he just
that becomes a work of art.
It
becomes this significant piece of history because, you know, the thing you got to remember, first of all, I got to go back to the Janosch film. The Janosch film has a break in it.
Right.
So, and we looked at that frame by frame where it's, okay, we think it's these people. Well, wait a minute. Then what happens? Could somebody have moved in? Could somebody have switched bots? Could somebody have just shifted? So there's no continuous film of the flag being raised, of the second flag being raised. So you take all that into consideration. But then, you know, and the film at the time was not digitized.
Right.
So you have those concerns. But when they get up to the mountain, nobody is thinking, I want to be a piece of history in terms of, you know, a memorial.
No, it's a working party.
There is one guy, I think it was the first flag, where somebody says, hey, get in here, you know, help, or, you know, get for one of the photos. And he says, you guys are a bunch of Hollywood Marines. Just put the damn flag up and let's go.
Wow.
So many people didn't even, that were on the mountain, didn't realize the significance of that for weeks, if not months, later on.
Right.
And most of that, number one, obviously, was the photo. The photo was gorgeous and just incredible. And then it was the World on Tour. They pulled all those guys back and wanted names because the beauty of that photo and the beauty of that statue is you don't see their faces.
Right.
You don't know who that is, and they're representing everybody on that island. And that was the wonderful thing about a corpsman being up there. It was not just the Marines. It was, you know, five Marines and a doc who represented all the Marines on Iwo Jima, all the Marines in the Pacific, and then all the Marines throughout history. That's the beautiful thing.
And then the image quickly takes on the
life of its own.
A life of its own as the struggle is,
mm-hmm.
is that this is the struggle that we're waging as a nation, which is why obviously the people on the war bond drive, you know, wanted them to come back. And so was there a piece of evidence that you looked at and you went, wow, that's really not him?
It was the photos. When you start looking at the photo, you don't even have to. We had a magnifying glass out at one point. And as I said, we're stopping. You know, the neat thing, I learned another thing about camouflage. It actually works. In one frame of Janosch film, it looks like somebody's wearing a helmet. And the very next frame, it looks like he's wearing a soft cover. And once you start looking into it, it's like because of the shadows and because what the camouflage had done with it. So it really was that simple. But there were moments where I just, you know, as one of my old chiefs said, did the four molar sock, where Ira Hayes said something along the lines of, the public information officer said to me when I said, hey, that's not Hansen, that's Block. He said, hey, suck it up. Just, we're going to get through this. We don't want to hear it. He alludes to, you know, those kind of statements,
right.
which kind of explains that maybe when Bradley, I believe, my opinion, when Bradley came back, he thought they were talking about the first flag raising.
Right.
And then he just gets swept up in this. And then at some point, when do you say, no, it's not me? I think it just went too far. But he wasn't a flag. He wasn't lying. I don't believe. You know, the man won the Navy Cross for saving Marines on Iwo Jima itself.
Yeah, a corpsman on Iwo Jima doesn't need to apologize for anything.
Absolutely. He did wonderful things. So, you know, and we've tried very hard from the commandant on down to say that to anybody willing to hear that, you know, I don't think Bradley lied and I don't think Bradley intended to do this. I do think there was a lot of good that the mistake was made. And it's a logic trail, but because
yeah,
he was there,
take us through that one because you and I were talking the other day. I would tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that Bradley knew that that wasn't him as he sat there and looked at that. Because like I said, you know, if you wore your leggings, you didn't take them off at the top of the mountain, and you know, just you know, and if you. You know, you look at that, and you knew what you wore that day, and you had that stuff with you all the time because that was your job. And, you know, and in the middle of doing this, they're getting shot at, right? And then the guys go bouncing down the hill and whatnot. And so, I mean, that's your job. That's what you do. And so, to me, one of the more interesting mental health pieces of it is, at some point, I believe Bradley realized that was not him. But
absolutely.
But
when?
When
that's the question,
and I am sure, and it was probably after the bond drive, and it's like, now if I come out and mm-hmm. say that that's not me, I'm going to get this, all that attention is going to be focused on me. Look, I mean, this thing's done. I don't, you know, I'm not going to do that. And you see Schultz acting in a very in like an extreme case of, hey, I'm done with that. I don't want to revisit it. I don't care if I wasn't named in it. Right? And then he never had his picture taken after World War II. What the hell?
Because you know what? You got to remember, there actually are shy people and introverts in this world, unlike people today, you know, where you get famous for doing terrible things.
Right.
There's, and I think that's part of this with Bradley. I believe that Bradley, nobody ever thought it would get this big. You know, when Bradley thought, probably right before the war, when he's probably talking to Daniel, he's talking to everybody, and he's like, wait a minute, I was in the first library, I wasn't in this one. And he basically gets told at some point by somebody, shut up and color, get through the war bond tour. Then I think he just thought it was over and done with. And then it kept taking on a life of its own. And now, next thing you know, they're building, Felix de Weldon is building this beautiful memorial.
Could you imagine Bradley? He's at home. He's resumed his life.
It's done.
Right? It's, this thing's done. You know, people bug me on occasion, but you know, it's this thing's going to depart. All of a sudden he breathes. The Marine Corps is good. The only service is going to put up their own war memorial. And it's going to be that. He probably went, oh, my God.
And you see a picture.
God hates me.
There's a picture of the three of them. And Bradley looks absolutely, at the dedication, Bradley looks absolutely miserable. But, you know, in many ways.
You know, I noticed that, and I thought, it's just me reading something into it. But there's a number of pictures of him that I've seen. One is sitting down, and then there's a couple other of him standing up. And I thought, well, it's just the horn-rimmed glasses and the black and white image. But he certainly doesn't, you know, he's not cracking a smile. And you would have think at some point, you know, you're seeing guys that, you know, you haven't seen for years. And there would be at least a picture of them smiling together. But he, as I agree with you, he does not seem happy about the whole thing.
No, I think and then at some point he's thinking it's over and done with. And remember that his son wrote the book after Bradley died.
Right.
Bradley died in 94, 95, I can't remember the exact year. But that's the goodness of what came out. Because that mistake was made, Bradley's son honestly thought his dad was there, and he wrote this wonderful book, and people read the book. So people who would not have been exposed to, you know, what went on in the Pacific Theater, specifically on Iwo Jima, specifically with the Marines, were exposed to it. And then of all people, Clint Eastwood makes not just that movie, but the companion piece.
Right.
So more and more people are exposed to it and learn about, you know, the incredible heroism and the sacrifices and dedication of Marines on Iwo Jima and all the other battles. So something good did come of what I believe is a mistake. I don't think it was deliberate. I don't think somebody like Bradley, who's, you know, typical salt-of-the-earth American who went to war to help his country, I don't think he ever thought it would get this big. Now, if somebody did it today, of course, we all be thinking, second-guessing them, going, sure, they want to make money off of it. It was a different time back then. It really was. And Bradley, you got to remember, Bradley was wounded on Iwo Jima. He was in the hospital when he got the call. He was in Balboa. He gets the call to come back to the East Coast, meet the president, and go out on the war bond tour. So you put all that together.
And the story is they show him what a newspaper clipping of the second flag raising and say, hey, they said you were in this. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm sure that, you know, like, well.
Daniel was the one who identified everybody initially.
Yeah.
Like, and then Bradley. I was up there that day.
Was I in that? I'm not exactly sure. Well,
yeah,
okay.
Which picture is that?
Yeah. And then he goes to D.C. and that's where you see the statements where he says, he gets told evidently to shut up and color, like, you're in this, okay? Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do the war bond tour. Wow.
Yep.
Poor Bradley. You can understand why he would tell his kids to just tell him I'm fishing.
Just tell him I'm fishing.
I don't want any
interviews. It's a bigger mystery to me because, I can follow that trail. The
right.
Schultz thing. You know, God bless them. But there are people like that who just don't want the publicity, who maybe he's talking to Bradley. Maybe he's talking to some of the others going, oh, I don't want any parts of that nonsense.
Well, he seems like an odd duck, though, because, I mean, when there's not an image of you that survives after World War II, and he was in his, what, early 20s after the war, and there's no, he sounds like he's maybe a shy guy.
He was, and he had, in addition to everything he went through, you know, throughout World War II. My understanding is his fiancée died while he was overseas, and that was very impactful to him. And then he didn't marry until he was in his 50s or 60s.
Right.
So, I think he was different. I think he was probably very introverted. Mm-hmm. By all accounts, just a good guy, just a very good, quiet man who didn't want the publicity. And, you know, Greatest Generation, they weren't, like I said, today's world, we can't understand them.
Right.
But back then, it was just put your nose to the grindstone. Don't praise yourself. Just do your job and move on. And so many of those guys went overseas, fought, saw their friends die in front of them, and came back thinking, you know, no way am I going to get publicity over something. You know, it's almost like stepping on your friend's grave.
You know, I had a his name's Cal Humphrey. He was a PFC on Iwo Jima, wound up being a squad leader. I want to say he was wounded 20 days into the battle. And I had him on the program a couple months ago. And first of all, it was just an awesome interview. And funny stuff, too. What's the best advice you ever got on Iwo Jima? Don't be the first one out of the fighting hole.
We're still alive.
That's what he said. And he said his squad leader told him that. He said, don't be in a hurry to get out of the foxhole.
The war will wait for you.
Exactly.
I don't think many people realize how many of the flag raisers were killed on Iwo Jima. On one day, Block, Strank, and Hansen, who now is in the first flag raiser, were all killed. Right. Bradley's wounded before he gets off the island, and Southley's killed on the 21st of March. So, you know, that's another thing. The guys who are actually there, because you think you're going to remember who's next to you. Well, before they get off the island, most of them are dead.
Right. And the other miracle of all of that is Ira Hayes doesn't get a scratch. How you go through that one and not get a scratch, that's the God who governs the flight of metal through the air, who we all know to be a very fickle person. Wow. Ira Hayes.
He is the one that there is no doubt, looking at all the photos, so many clear shots of Ira Hayes, and he has a very distinctive profile.
Right.
We know it was him, and he's another one. He didn't want the publicity either. Right. When Gagnon went back, Hayes said to him, "Don't you dare tell him it was me. I don't want any parts of this.
Or I'll kill you." Well, that's the story I read. And then Gagnon, the initial statement that the PAO guy says is that Gagnon wouldn't tell him, right, who the sixth guy was. And he had to call him back and said, "Hey, look, this war bond needs that Marine, and you've got to tell me. It's your duty to tell me." And he said that he clearly, visibly, full of anxiety about giving up Hayes' name.
Because Hayes is going
to
hurt him.
I talked to Mike Musselman, and he said, "You know, it's my experience in the Marine Corps, when a Native American Marine says they're going to kill you, they normally mean that." And we laughed. When those guys come back and Bradley is faced with that, the PAO guys have a stake in this too, because they don't want to be wrong in front of God and everybody as well.
Right, they do. And we could do a whole discussion on public affairs during World War II. It's absolutely fascinating how many were civilians in real, you know, were pulled in reservists to run the public affairs.
Wow.
But, you know, keep in mind, it's February, March 1945. We've been at war for several years now. The country's tired. You know, it's not like, you know, people are dying a couple here, a couple there in every battle. I mean, we're taking some significant losses. So, and money's running tight. So they needed this war bond tour, and they needed to something like this to re-energize the American people who are war weary at this point. You know, if somebody in their family's not over there either in Europe or the Pacific, somebody they know is. So how do you get energized again? So, and that was on the responsibility of the public information officers at the time. And you know, God bless them for just trying to get the job done, and helping the American people say, "Hey, we got to push it to the finish line."
And my guest this morning is a retired Marine Colonel Mary Reinwald. She is the editor of Leatherneck magazine, and Mary, you wrote a piece about this that appeared in August, Leatherneck.
I did. I actually wrote one on the second flag raising for the August issue of Leatherneck, and I wrote another one that will appear in our October issue on the first flag raising when the Yulee panel reconvened and looked at the first flag raisers.
Okay, so of the second flag raising, who's the least identifiable person? Is that Strank? Is the least identifiable person?
And I would say Strank.
What did you use to say, "Hey, we believe this is Mike Strank"? What were the pieces of evidence that identify Strank?
Well, again, so many of that was the eyewitness statements. There was never anybody that came back and said, "No, it wasn't Strank." But he was the one, as we're going through the film and we're going through the videos, you're looking very closely to say, "Hey, is there any identifying marks?" Part of it is where he was at the beginning. we said, okay, you can follow it through, and we made some assumptions. I said when the panel was over, I will go to my grave knowing that that is Ira Hayes in the back. And there's a couple more that I'm 99% that Southley. Strank is the one that I think, him and Block, I'm not, you know, absolutely certain, but I'm certain enough that I believe it's them. Because again, nobody's ever made any counter accusations. And then as we followed the evidence through, it looked like him. At one point we were trying to see if it was Bradley, that maybe they had reversed the poll or they turned or he jumped on the other side. But then there was a ring. There was a ring that showed it with that Bradley had a ring on and the person in this position did not. So nothing led us to believe it wasn't Strank, and the evidence, the available evidence all said it was. But we just didn't have a clear shot at his face to say, oh, without a doubt, like we did with Hayes. Hayes was a piece of cake.
What about, can you see Mike Strank in the Janos video? Does that add to it?
You can see him walk up and you know it's Strank, and then you see them lined up and you say, oh yeah, that's Strank. And then again, but that break in that film is where, and especially Strank is the squad leader. Strank's right. The senior man there. So, you know, we actually were of two minds. The board was almost split at one point because my belief is that Strank wouldn't have jumped on. He would have been supervising. Somebody else said, well, no, he would have been helping his Marines. So nobody's right, nobody's wrong necessarily, but it was just two approaches.
The grunts are always right. Can we establish that?
And it was a grunt who said it, a grunt brigadier general.
Exactly. He said it, so we're going with what he said. All right. Can we take a quick break and talk about the first flag racing?
Sure.
Because and the thing that I find most interesting about this is after 70, you know, years, right? How could some new information, how could this happen? You know, and I remember that when I first saw the article, I was blown away. And then the story's even, you know, becomes more odd. The two pieces of information, you know, Stephen Foley, you know, and Eric Crelly, that whole thing. But also from Hollywood, you know, I had Mike Morgan on, and he talked about Sergeant Major Deaver doing technical advising on Flight of Our Father. The first time he heard it was a prop manager says, hey, can you explain this to me? And he said, that was in 2004, he said, look at these pictures. This is Bradley, but this is him in the picture? Like, well, what do I do?
Yeah.
He like,
how did we miss it for so
what?
Long?
Look at that. That's Bradley? You know, and I think we all kind of assume, like, yeah, he's not changing his clothes up there on top of the mountain. You got to be kidding me. But you know what? Nobody noticed that. It just seems so crazy that nobody would have looked at those two pictures and said, yeah, we need to pull the string on that one because it doesn't look right. But anyway, all right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the first flag raising and the information about that. My guest this morning on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio is the editor of Leatherneck Magazine. Her name is Colonel Mary Reinwald, retired from Penn State. More from her next on the All Marine Radio Network.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
General Sergeant Arley Ermey here with important information for veterans. At 2,600 American job centers nationwide, veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you. And we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Eight 39 on a Tuesday. Feels like a Monday. We continue. My guest this morning from Leatherneck Magazine, the editor, Colonel Mary Reinwald. What was your major at Penn State?
I was a political science major.
Meaningless degree. Or do you regret do you regret that decision? You could have done something like English. You know, here's my philosophy. If you don't get accounting, engineering, do English. Because the rest of it is all nonsense. What do you think of that?
I would disagree. But, you know, I think at this point, and it's interesting because I've been hiring people here at Leatherneck for the association and for the magazine itself, the degree is important, but the actual major, unless you're talking something specific, like I have a daughter who's a financial analyst. Yeah. Yes, she needed to major in finance. But my dad said to me, what are you going to do with a poli-sci degree? I said, he was a lawyer. I said, hey, Dad, it didn't hurt you too badly. And one of my daughters is a brat.
Oh, so you were a lippy kid in addition to being a brat.
Oh, my God, yes. That's why I joined the Marine Corps. Absolutely. I said I was one of seven. You had to be lippy to survive.
Holy smokes. I think English is a great major, and I'm an economics major. I think I did derive some benefit from it in terms of abstracting and problem solving and learning how to move variables and mm-hmm. quantify them and things like that. But I told my kids, and none of them followed my advice. If you don't know what you want to do, do English. You'll be well read, well written, and you should be well spoken, and those things will serve you for most of your life. And
but the best piece of advice that I've ever developed and given to my children is never help an English major move because they have too many books and books are heavy. Because I've had two of my good friends were English majors, and I agree with everything you said, but I remember just moving carton after carton of books when with a friend of the basic school going, for the love of God. And she said, hey, I'm an English major. That's what we do. We read.
Well, why don't you throw them away? Throw a few away. You don't got to keep them. Give them to a library.
Well, because you know what? Marines don't throw anything away, especially male Marines. Don't get
me I didn't know. All right.
So they're wise, wait till they deploy, and then you clean the house out.
Yeah, you know what? That should be the... Then who's to blame for the whole thing? It certainly isn't the male Marine.
Oh, no, because he it's just, we're supposedly talking about my husband, but he'll tell you, my husband was a grunt. He's like, hey, this is Marine Corps history. This is all about the history. You can't throw out history.
Yeah. You can't throw out my I Love Me stuff. The books, you could probably ditch a few of those. Hey, they wouldn't even know.
Comes from the basic school, from 1984. We can throw them out.
Exactly. What? Where's the binder full of those, you know?
Oh, yeah, the black binders with the...
Yeah, Manual of Arms with the sword. You don't think I need that? What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
The first flag raising.
Sure.
When Charlie Niemeyer was on, he said, you know, on a regular basis, we get correspondence, be it phone calls or letters that say, hey, you know, my father recently passed away, and he said that he was on that hill that day, and he was in the first picture, and that there were people misidentified in the first picture. That's not this guy. That's this guy. And he said, you know, it happens with... on a regular basis, less so now than it has in the past. But, you know, there was, and, you know, we constantly relied on relative to the second flag raising, the Duvalier report that came out, what, 1946 or 47?
Right.
And he said, you know, but the first flag, there was, you know, we never really looked at that. So talk about the first flag raising. And first of all, what's the reason to go back and identify those guys relative to the first flag raising?
You know, and the commandant said it's our history, and our history is important, and you want to make sure you get it right. I actually had a letter to the editor after the August issue on the second flag raising, and the guy said, why are you doing this? You know, why are you changing our history? It's like, we didn't have it right. You know, you want to make sure that the correct – and you walk in a fine balance. You want to make sure you're correctly identifying the right people, but, you know, again, it was a working party. Everybody on that island was important. Everybody on that island was contributing to the effort. But still, that's the iconic photo. And we have publicized those names over the years. And in my mind, and thank God for the panels I sat on, because it really reminded me, it was the first flag raising that was the really significant flag raising. The second flag raising, because of that photo, became the more important one. But the first flag raising to the Marines who'd been, you know, not just fighting on Iwo Jima for 5 days at that point, but in the fighting, you know, island hopping campaign, had seen their brothers in arms killed, that flag going up on Iwo Jima meant something, and it was that first flag. So of course we need to get that right. Now, and I've heard over the years that a lot of the first flag raisers and their families have been a little put out because the second flag raisers got all the publicity. But so, you know, you put all that together and you think, yeah, we got to recognize these guys too and recognize, you know, the guys that provided security. Because right then on the mountain, who do you think is more important, the guy with the rifle in his hands or the guy with the pipe who's putting up a flag? You know, if the guy's putting up the flag wouldn't have been there if the guy with the rifle's not doing his job.
You know,
so
I met Charles Lindbergh, who was part of the first flag raising.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you see a kind of a broad-shouldered dude with a flamethrower on his back up there, that is mm-hmm. Charles Lindbergh. And
right.
I lived up in North Dakota for about 14 years, and they had a flood. So they rededicated their veterans memorial, and he's from Grand Forks, North Dakota. He was living down towards Minneapolis at the time, and he and his wife came up, and so I got a chance to meet him. And I actually took the company guide on that my Marines gave me, and I had him sign it. And
wow.
I said, I would never let another Marine touch this, let alone sign it. But you are a part of Marine Corps history, and, you know, would you sign this? So I was sitting there talking to he and his wife, and they were pissed. And this is 1999, maybe 2000. They were pissed still, and she. I remember her telling me vividly, you know what, they've never been recognized for what they did. You know, everybody knows those other names. Those guys didn't do anything. They were a working party. You know, my husband and the guys in his squad and platoon, they're the ones that went up there and put the first flag up. And nobody even knows about him. So, you know, he still goes around and speaks and tells the story of the first flag raising to school children around the Minneapolis area. And he's been doing this since he retired. And they were adamant, though, and they were not happy about it.
And they're right, because if you go through so many of the books, it's like, well, the first flag was raised to 1020. The second flag, and then they go into the level of detail, the names, the, you know, what units they're from. So I can understand, but I keep going, you know, I keep going back to the same thing of they just happened to be at the right place at the right time. It wasn't, you know, they weren't getting the Medal of Honor as they worked their way up the mountain on either one of them. So if they were, they happened to be there, they played a role, but they were representing everybody else, which is the beautiful thing of the picture itself. So I understand why they're pissed because the other people got the recognition, but in the big scheme of things, you know, we should know all the Medals of Honor winners. You know, have them memorized, not necessarily just the flag raisers, but they're all part of our history. So it's not a zero-sum game, and I think some people try and make it out to be. But I will tell you the one thing I learned with both flag raisings is the value of records and record-keeping, not just from a public affairs standpoint, but also from, you know, we scoured the roles of not just the platoons, the companies, but the battalions, and go, wait a minute, how could so-and-so get up the mountain? How could he think, you know, he said he reached the summit that day. Wait, his company wasn't even in the vicinity. How did that happen?
Right.
And so there's a lot of people we know made it up the mountain, and there's several that we couldn't identify, either because they weren't on the rolls or nobody ever identified them in a picture, or, you know, and that made it very, very challenging. So when you start, you know, cross-referencing things and you're like, okay, yeah, okay, that's Lieutenant Trier. You know, not because I see a lieutenant insignia, but because he's identified in numerous pieces of evidence. And so you worry about that stuff across the board of, okay, photographs, the battalion rosters, you know, books that were written, hopefully books that were written pretty soon after the war, not 50 years later. You put all that together and you figure out who's up there and who was there at the right time. Because we have evidence, one of the original PSC Charlo, he was listed as one of the original first flag raisers. Well, he went down the mountain. He made his way back up the mountain at some point, but it was well after the first flag raising. So he was removed from the list. The other guy, I think it was PSC Michaels, he was providing security. He was there, but there's no evidence that he ever touched the flagpole. And by evidence, it's specifically the photograph that Lou Lowry took.
And so is he in the... So what are the modifications to the first photo? Are there additions and deletions to the first photo?
Yes, we took out PFC Charlo, Louis C. Charlo, and PFC Michaels. And this is, like I said, I love irony. The two that were added were Doc Bradley and Sergeant Hansen. And Hansen was the one who was originally thought to be in position one on the second flag raising. And obviously, Bradley was the one thought to be in position four on the second flag raising.
So the two guys that are eliminated at different points in time, one in, what, 1946, 47, and the other one in 2016, both then get added to the first flag raising.
Both get added.
Wow. Wow. Give me a lesson or two lessons learned. You've already talked about records, but I will tell you this, and it's not good radio to compliment the Marine Corps. It's better when you rip them. But I will tell you, we both know that. But I would tell you that I thought the Marine Corps handled this, you know, in a very solid, responsible way, and I thought the things that have been said by not only the commandant but the people that have been on the board have all been extremely solid in terms of the way they approached it, because it is such a sacred event in our history, but a responsibility that everybody felt for the truth, and that the truth had to be the driving force, and I think that always reflects well on you when your motivation is the truth, and I think the Marine Corps handled it exceedingly well.
Absolutely. And from General Neller on down, General Neller got it. And, you know, remember, General Neller was the president of the Marine Corps University. So the history division fell under him, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. I can't remember. So plus, he's a prolific writer for the Gazette. He has a wonderful appreciation for the history of the Marine Corps. And he knows the importance of getting it right. And General Glenn, the public affairs officer for the Marine Corps now, all those guys and their staffs, I think, just did a tremendous job of, hey, we may have made a mistake. Good and well-intentioned, but we may have made a mistake. I don't believe people lied. I don't believe people were out for their own, personal satisfaction.
Well, the PAO guys kind of did a little number on it. I won't call it lying, though. They strong-armed a little bit. But you know what? The PAO people are what they are. You know, they got one leg in Hollywood, one leg in the Marine Corps. And so that's why more than any other group of MOSs in the Marine Corps, they need to be supervised. So it's a good reminder to the rest of us.
But we don't, and here's the other thing, and I learned this with the Joe Paterno thing, to go back to my Penn State roots. It's a wonderful reminder. We don't always know the other side of the story. And we have to be careful about, you know, that's, okay, so Hayes said that. Did Hayes misinterpret something the public affairs officer said? Was the public information officer in a rush? You know, was he under pressure from the president? Was he told by his boss, shut up and call her, make it happen?
Right.
So you just don't know.
Well, we can assume that got that comment. Look.
He was persona non grata by the time the board ended, let me tell you.
Well, that poor guy, and all he gets told from, you know, whoever's organizing the war bond tour via the White House is, look, this is big money. This is a big deal, okay? Look, I don't give a shit about the story. You get those Marines there and that sailor guy there because they're going up on that thing, and we got to pay for the war. Like, hello? You know, what else are we going to do? Just print more money? Oh, that comes later.
As far as lessons go, I was recently at the Combat Correspondence Conference, and I was talking to several Marines, and I said, you know, so many things, you know, backups. When you're recording history for the Marine Corps, you know, have two or three cameras going. Ask people's names. Get copies of command chronologies. I was talking to a historian last week, and we all agreed that, you know, we all hated writing. I was the ad, so, you know, between me and the three, we were writing chronology everywhere I ever was.
Are you kidding me? That is the painful words of, what are you working on? Why are you so unhappy? Command chronology, man, it's killing me.
But do you know, 30, 40, 50 years later, they are so valuable.
Right.
Rosters are valuable. You know, it's really the – and today we are inundated. As I said, we're inundated between us and the History Division. People are constantly sending us stuff unsolicited or asking us if we want them. My dad's an Iwo Jima vet, and you want to talk to them. You absolutely do. And we may get them. And then it's like, okay, now we've got a catalog. Now we've got to archive it. How do we get it all together? In today's information age, it's almost overwhelming. So you have to be able to manage this and be able to, you know, and publish it in the right way. And the other big, big lesson I learned is that eyewitness accounts are not always reliable. And people's memories are not always reliable. Because somebody was there and they said this happened. I don't think they're lying, but that doesn't mean it really happened.
Yeah,
so, you know, second,
Bradley's,
third, fourth order.
Bradley's statement in 1946 that he signed, that he was part of it.
And was he lying if he's thinking it's the first flag raising? Bradley also said later on that he wasn't in the first flag raising, and we have video evidence photographic evidence that he was there. So
he was an undertaker. All right, let's just leave him alone. Can I ask you some current event questions?
Navy Cross winner.
Yeah, you and I both know how those guys came home and lived normal lives. If you were a corpsman, I still to this day, and I don't care what war you've ever participated in, when you have to do emergency medicine to your friends. I mean, we're not talking about we're rolling around in an ambulance and we're doing it for people we don't know, right? And we may be disturbed by what we see, but it has no other, you know, emotional. When you're doing it to your best friends, how you come home and regain your sanity is, I still to this day don't know. God bless every one of them, corpsmen, medics, the whole nine yards.
Absolutely.
That is, to me, that's the roughest job going.
Oh, and, you know, and I love how Marines feel about their corpsmen. My father-in-law was a corpsman in Vietnam with the Marines, and raised three sons. Every one of them became an infantry officer. So, you know, the impact he had, obviously. But the corpsmen are sacred. And, you know, I work with a lot of my staff are not Marines, not veteran Marines, have no connection to the Marine Corps. They just may be a specialist or a marketer or a writer. And, you know, trying to explain to them the way Marines feel about their docs is we do obituaries. The only non-Marines we do in Leatherneck in memoriam are principally your docs. Every now and then a chaplain will sneak in. But if it's a doc, it's like you don't have to ask my permission, put it in. He's a doc. He served with Marines. We'll take care of him.
They're sacred. They're sacred.
Absolutely.
The my guest this morning from Leatherneck Magazine is the editor. Her name is Mary Reinwald. She's a retired colonel. All right, Mary, will you come back and do this again? I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've kept you too long, but thank you very much, first of all, for coming on and discussing the your article, examining the evidence. And the next article about the first reading, the first flag raising, comes out in October or November?
Comes out the October issue of Leatherneck.
All right. And where does everybody find the electronic copy of Leatherneck?
It's on the MCA website, but you have to be a member to access it, or you can go to our Facebook page, Marine Corps Association Foundation, and we'll have a link to this article. It'll be a free article on our Facebook page. But we do highly encourage everybody to join the Marine Corps Association and Foundation, both to get Leatherneck and or the Gazette, but more importantly, all of our dues and our donations that we get all support Marines and Marines professional military education, from unit libraries to battlefield studies to speakers to the awards. Any award you've ever gotten as the Chesty Puller Award at Boot Camp for being the honor grad to writing awards, they're sponsored by the Marine Corps Association and Foundation.
And I will tell you, if you're a writer or if you're a reader, what Mary said about the archives, I remember reading, I don't know what I was going to write about Iwo Jima, but I went back and looked for articles between 1945 and 1960 or 65 about Iwo Jima. And it was incredible to read first-person accounts of what they did on that island. And it's not like with the long lens of history. These guys are, you know, right, first and second person, I, he, we, you know, they, I mean, those pronouns are used in the article, not they. So,
well, they also wrote it. I pulled an article for our Iwo Jima issue, and I think it was this February, written by a company commander in early April 1945 about what his company did on Iwo Jima, you know, less than 2 months after they set foot on the island, and he wrote it.
Awesome stuff. All right, but you'll come back, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, Mary, first of all, thank you very much for the visit. Appreciate it very much. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
You bet. That is Colonel Mary Reinwald. Retired United States Marine Corps. She is the editor of the Marine Corps Gazette. Leatherneck. Sorry about that. I'll get it right.
That's okay. It happens all the time.
All right. We're taking.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Joey Perazzo is going to join us. He's a former Marine Lieutenant Colonel, F-18 guy, and we're going to learn about him. And he's got a. He's doing some cool stuff. And we're. Trying to help veterans give them something they're passionate in terms of a sport or a hobby. And then so that's what they're about. So it's called Warrior Passion. So we're going to talk to him right after this as we continue on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't go anywhere.